Peace, party people. I'm back with episode 153, Hip Hop Ginger Shop Part 3. I'm going to talk about an article by Jason England called 50 Years Later about hip hop. I do a twofer. I got a review. I got a review on the 1/4 documentary on Netflix and Godzilla Minus One. You're going to love this joint. Talk about Diddy and what happened and what we really need to be focusing on. And then also talk about U.S. foreign policy with Israel and Palestine. Word is born. Let's get it on. And thank you for coming back. Killer tape at, B. I know it's been a minute since I hit y'all, but I want to finish up this series of the 50th anniversary of Hip Hop Ginger Shot. But I would start to record, I start to like outline what I want to say, and I come off as real bitter. I'm 50 years old, by the way. I've been a participant in hip hop culture for since I was 6 years old, since 1979. I was a member of Zulu Nation for 18 years. Y'all know my pedigree. But with the state of hip hop culture, I'm not happy. I'm not satisfied. And a lot of times I think I come off as bitter. You know what I mean? And I don't even think my explanations are you know, legitimate. You know, I sound real bitter. So I'm like, should I do it? Should I not do it? And then, you know, next thing you know, the news comes out about Diddy and how a lot of us were right about Diddy decades ago, about how he's a horrible person and who exploits his artists. And there were all these rumors about him, you know, being really wild when it comes to women. But it's just the people around him are always, they become damaged goods. And the latest situation with him just proves my point. And then it goes back to, you know, episode the part two of this series when I talk about, you know, Russell Simmons and Afrika Bambaataa, right? And Dr. Dre and that article by Gene Hampton. And it's just like, I want to talk about this article. And it's just, It proves me right. And maybe I'm not right, but I'm not bitter at all. I'm angry, right? I'm frustrated at my generation because we dropped the ball. So definitely, if I come off as bitter, I don't know. That's not my point. But hopefully we can have this discussion. Word. Yes. I want to talk about Palestine for a minute because I guess motherfuckers in hip-hop don't care, right? The thing about the Israeli invasion, and it's an invasion, right? And it's wild how the mainstream media, aka the fourth branch of the government, continues to couch it as if like it's a conflict, a conflict with equal footing, with forces that are about the same, and it's not. It is the Israeli Defense Force bombing the shit out of civilians. That's what it is, you know? But I think that what we're seeing is us continuously couch this debate as, oh, you know, you're either anti-Semitic or you're not. You need to denounce Hamas, or if you don't denounce Hamas, then you are anti-Semitic. It's like, that's the consistent debate that we see in the mainstream media, even on the internet. Like, if you're a pro-Palestinian, you can get flagged. Like, until we get out of that debate, we will never see a solution. You know what I mean? We will never see Israel taken against war crimes. And here's why. Because IDF is not the problem. Israeli government is not the problem. It's U.S. foreign policy, right? And one example I could give you is the example of how the United States supports the Ukraine, right? And the Palestinians are in the exact same situation, a superpower, because Israel is a superpower. They have nuclear weapons. Invades a country that's not as powerful as them and just runs through the people, just kills civilians and destroys civilian infrastructure, right? That the people need to survive. But when it happens in Palestine, it's like, here's why. And I want you to think about this. The reason why supporting the Ukraine helps U.S. foreign policy is because it keeps Russia destabilized. It doesn't allow Russian hegemony into that part of Europe. The reason why the United States government supports Israel is because Israel destabilizes the Middle Eastern region and keeps the Middle Eastern countries on their toes. That is part of U.S. foreign policy. How do I know this? Simple. You cannot tell me that a country that is initially anti-Semitic, right? Henry Ford republished the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. A lot of the GOP are anti-Semitic, right? A lot of the right-wing factions that the GOP supports are anti-Semitic, right? And all of a sudden, you know, and remember in World War II, the U.S. government was very quiet about how the Nazis were treating Jews in the concentration camps, right? And the world didn't really see what was going on until U.S. soldiers happened upon places like Auschwitz, right? All of a sudden, we support an Israeli state in 1948. Right, it doesn't make any fucking sense whatsoever. Right, it's not really about Zionists; it's about U.S. foreign policy. And until we start talking about that, right, then we can understand why the U.S. government buttresses and supports the Israeli Defense Force, their military, their intelligence gathering, all of it, the Mossad, that's the CIA. That's all that is, right? And I'm not trying to get into conspiracy theory here, but it's just that's the actual analysis. It supports U.S. foreign policy. Israel, having the state of Israel there destabilizes the region, right? And once we get that out of the way, once we discuss that, then the things about Ukraine make sense. Then how the U.S. government feels about Palestine makes sense, right? It is a genocide on the Israeli part, and it's one that the U.S. government fully supports. And it's always supported, always supported, because the U.S. government has never denounced any of the actions the Israelis have done. And has asked anybody that if they want to discuss issues, they have to denounce the Palestinians, whether it's the Palestinian Liberation Organization, right, Hamas, or anything, right? And it's very clear, right? What bothers me is that people are shocked that black people support the Palestinian liberation. We've always had. It's part of our liberation as well, right? And then they've always supported us, right? So, but again, we got to get out of that debate. So first of all, I got to shout out the big homie Zemo, friend of the show. Sometimes he's in here with us doing his thing, Thizzle, right? He sent me an article a couple months ago, actually. It's called 50 Years Later, Is There Anything Left of Hip Hop? And this was published by the Defector.com. It's by Jason England. And when he sent me this, I was like, it sounds like something that I would write, right? Not as good as Jason England. I'm not even going front. Probably nowhere near as good as he is. I will put the article in the show notes for those that are already asking. There's in the third paragraph, the fourth paragraph of the article, he says, as successions Logan Roy proclaimed, money wins. Greg Tate, rest in perfection, the late great Greg Tate, wrote that story on hip hop's 30th birthday. In December of 2004, Tate assured that 20 years from now, we'll be able to tell our grandchildren and great-grandchildren how we witnessed cultural genocide, the systemic destruction of a people's folkways. Back then, Tate laughed at the people who gathered for a birthday party when, in his view, they were really presiding over a funeral. Hip-hop had died the moment it fully married into global hyper-capitalism. And global hyper-capitalism, that's like the word I was looking for. Shout out to the late, great Greg Tate for that. If you don't know who he is, then we can't be friends, right? But it's wild to me. I never would have thought that I would have saw KRS-One rapping for the mayor of New York City, who's pretty much, you know, a cop hardliner, right? I don't want to mention his name, but he did Black Cop at his show. Like, that's crazy. That is crazy. We have, you know, Ice Cube, who was, You know, I know in Boondocks they joked about him being a gangster rapper, flirting with right wing folks. You know what I mean? Like sounding like a conservative, or like a hack for the GOP. You know what I mean? And then like Jay-Z, who's kind of had really helped gentrify Brooklyn. You know what I mean? It's funny because England says in his article, he says that he went from aiding Bruce Rad and expediting Brooklyn's gentrification to bringing Bitcoin to Marcy while cosplaying Basquiat. Like, he said that shit, I fucking passed out. You know, you have like artists, hip hop artists going on Joe Rogan's show, who's a fucking hack. You know what I mean? Then it's like, he talks about how Killer Mike is glad Reagan died, but then he's expressing affinity for Candace Owens, right? And in conversation with the Dalai Lama, like, what the hell has happened? Like, what are we doing? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not proud of any of this. I'm not saying that I expected hip hop to be socialist, right? I just don't. But like, come on, cuz, what are we doing here, right? If what's going on in Palestine today happened, you know, 25 years ago, hip hop artists will be talking about that. And I'm not even talking about the conscious ones, right? It'll be something that we're talking about, right? But we're not. You know what I mean? You guys got to read this article. Is very, 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 very long, but I think it's worth it. Because he really outlines like what we need to be talking about, right? And this hypercapitalism, this global hypercapitalism, it's not a good look, bro. It's not, and I never expected it to be that. And it's funny because I remember I was watching a Matt Hoffa episode where they had Dee Angeletti on there, and one of the other hosts is like challenging him on his concept of, because he was saying something about Talib Kweli. Like he could have sold more records, but that he chose not to. And it was just kind of like, it was okay for him to, and you know, Talib Kweli is another topic for another day, but D Dot is very, very open about his lack of integrity. You know what I mean? He went from Two Kings in a Cypher, TKO, to, you know, really hating on his original fan base. And you know, he was doing this 30 years ago, right? And it's like, we've come to a reckoning. You know what I mean? Like, we really come to a reckoning. And I just am, you know, again, I sound bitter, I sound wild, but I can't do a hip-hop celebration. I can't do a hip-hop celebration. I really cannot do a hip-hop celebration because we're literally, like, celebrating our deaths, right? We're commodifying black bodies and saying that we're disposable. That's what we're doing here, right? Which we started doing a while ago. What are we gonna do, yo? I'm gonna keep it a little bit light and I'm gonna do another movie review. Godzilla Minus One. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that a Godzilla movie would be considered one of the top 10 movies of 2023? I didn't see that coming. Right? And I'm going to say this. As a young blood, I was a fan of the old school Godzilla movies from Japan with the dudes in the suits. I loved it. I ain't even going to lie to you. I ain't even going to hold you on that one. You know what I mean? But the modern Godzilla movies, I be passing out because I be sleeping in there, man. I be getting like a nice 1 hour nap, you know, because they be dry. And I be like, yo, Godzilla, just pull up and kill everybody because this is dry. I don't care about these people, right? And it's funny because they'll get like good actors. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, Takashi Yamasaki, director and writer of Godzilla Minus One, put together a nice little joint that takes place right after the war. I mean, it starts in 1945. And our protagonist, right, is a young man named Goichi Shikishima. He's a kamikaze pilot, a failed kamikaze pilot, right? Failed one, you know what I'm saying? And he lands on an island. And he tells him, hey, I had an issue with my plane. I wasn't able to complete my mission. You know what I'm saying? But the crew realized there was nothing wrong with his plane, so they start to give him the side eye. Before they can address the issue, young Godzilla pulls up. A young Godzilla pulls up. My man is like maybe maybe 45, 50 feet tall, you know, and tears everybody up. And the homie Koichi and this other cat who's like a crew chief, Yoji Akitsu. I got his name wrong, right? Tachibana, that's the homie. He's like a crew chief. He's the only survivors, right? So Koichi returns back to his home, find his home has been bombed in the United States. There's nothing left of it. His family died, you know what I mean? And while he's in there, he meets a woman named Noriko who is running. She stole something and she has a baby with her, Akiko, and hands him the baby. And all of a sudden, our man is now a father. Don't get me wrong, Noriko comes back around and they end up staying in his family's, what's left of his family's home. You know what I mean? Then he gets a job as a minesweeper with a nice little crew and he keeps everything to himself. So mind you, Koichi suffers from PTSD and survivor's guilt. And don't get it wrong, you know, his neighbors are looking at him side-eye because they're like, damn, you should have died in the war because you signed up to be a kamikaze pilot, you know? So it's real dope because it makes you really, like, you really side with Koichi. You really try to be like, yo, son, you want to see him live, you know? And let me say this about Godzilla. He's not seen as an anti-hero in this. He doesn't save nobody. He's seen as this destructive force that's out to destroy everything in his path. And every time he pulls up, shit is real. Japanese military is gone. The United States is like, we don't give a fuck. You know what I mean? We worried about the Soviets. So the Japanese people are left to fend for themselves. And they figure it out. Let me say this. Great drama, great writing, great acting. Despite the language barrier, you can still feel the pain. You can still understand what Koichi and his crew are going through. And really, it's about community and pulling together. Godzilla is terrifying. And remember, this movie was made for $15 million. So they ain't used no CGI because I don't know what they did, but it looks very real. There's a scene where there's a television crew and an audio crew is recording Godzilla as he destroys the city. And they're on his rooftop. And Godzilla just happens to just whip his tail around and take out the foundation of the building. And as they're falling, you feel like you're falling too. You feel like, yo, we all gonna die here. You know what I mean? And I thought that was really dope. So highly recommend it. I'm telling you, everybody's gonna be talking about it. You should definitely check it out. And it's, you know, it's good enough to watch for the family. It doesn't get too gory. You know what I'm saying? But I'm gonna say this, hands down, the best Godzilla movie of all time. And you can fight me on that. Word. That Diddy shit. Crazy, right? And here's the wild part. Not surprised. I'm not. And it's not. And I know that over the years, there's all these rumors. And that's another issue, right? All these rumors about his homo, you know, he's homoerotic. He's bisexual. He rapes men and shit like that. And, you know, I think that's homophobic, what people say about him. I know he's sexually depraved, the shit that he does, clearly, you know, according to Cassie's testimony. But we need to chill with that homophobic shit. Like, we really need to chill with that. Like, just because somebody's sexually depraved doesn't mean that they're gay. And again, being gay is not a bad thing. It's just the whole point is consent. Are you getting consent, right? But we've always heard all these rumors and shit about Diddy and how he got down. And here it is. It's the proof is in the pudding. Never seen a case that was settled so quickly before. You know, what was it, like 24 hours he settled that? And I think he settled it because he would have to, you know, if Cassie's testimony was like, if they went through it line by line and they sat in court and talked about it, then I think a lot of other people would have been indicted because of those discussions in the courtroom, and they would have been on record, and other people would have had to settle, and there probably would have been some criminal charges. So I think that's why he did that. Because if it was just him alone in the sinking ship, he probably would have fought it. But everybody else, he would have had to tell everybody else. And you know, Cassie outlines that there was other people involved, you know, and I guess they didn't want to put that in the court and, you know, go through the courts with that because they would have to bring those people in. But we see that there's other lawsuits against Diddy from other people. And real quick, I want to say this. I want to say that we are like really focusing on the Diddy case because it's a big high-profile case. And for some people, these allegations are shocking, even though it shouldn't be. But there's like something deeper that we need to discuss about that, right? We should. I want to spin off of talking about Diddy for just one moment. So why is all this significant, right? Because the reason why Cassie filed that lawsuit was because the Adult Survivors Act expired in New York State. However, there was a one-year, what was called a look-back window, which ran from November 24th, 2022 until November 24th, 2023, giving them the opportunity to raise claims that would, you know, before they just couldn't get because of the statute of limitations, right? That being said, what people are not focusing on, and because I know it's not glamorous, and I know that people in prison are not seen as human beings, particularly women. Nearly 1,500 claims have been filed against the state of New York by incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women. Like, oh, by the way, let me just say there's been 2,600 claims, right, overall, right, because of the Adult Survivors Act expiring, right? But almost two-thirds of those claims are from incarcerated women. And that's what, we're not talking about that, right? We're not talking about that. It's funny because I remember talking to a comedian about, you know, about how a lot of comedians joke about prison rape. And it was a deep dive, you know what I mean? A lot of people was like, yeah, I didn't think about it like that. But again, prisoners are seen as second-class citizens. And I mean, let's talk about the other cases, the other 1,100 cases, right, by women, right, mostly women, for a case, you know, with those suits against sexual misconduct, rape, assault. And no one's talking about that. In 1 year, that many was filed before the date ended on November 24th. Like, let's talk about that, right? Like, because hip-hop isn't doing it, right? If anything, we're denying it. We're being delusional about it, right? In Dream Hampton's article, she talks about how the Mount Rushmore of hip-hop have all been accused of assaults against women. Now we see Diddy, someone who oversaw, you know, groups like Jodeci, you know, and also Mary J. Blige. He was their A&R. And then he put on Biggie and Craig Mack and created Bad Boy and influenced the careers of several people, made millionaires of a lot of other people, right? Particularly black people. And he is also a monster. Like, all that. And what is hip hop saying? A lot of people are coming to his rescue. A lot of people are saying he's innocent, right? Wow. And it's just like, Dream Hampton wasn't bullshit. You know, like, here we are again. It's fucking crazy. I was cruising on Netflix and ran across this documentary about the 1-4. Never was really into drill rap. Tried to get into it in the United States. A lot of the artists, I just couldn't understand what they were saying. I know a lot of this because I'm older and the slang is different from when I was younger. But with this group of 1-4, these Australian drill rappers, I could hear every word they said. So the beats were hot. The beats were fucking dope. So I checked it out and I was impressed. So Netflix released this documentary in October about this group called the 1-4. And the 1-4 is a rap group that comes from the, Mount Truitt, suburb in Sydney, Australia. And from there, they have a lot of, Australia, like a lot of countries, they have a lot of immigrants that come from across the Pacific. And a lot of these are New Zealanders, Samoans, some mixture of them. And the members that make up the 1-4 would be YP, Lex, JM, Spenny, and Selly. Throughout the course of their career, what ended up happening was three of the members ended up going to jail. So two of them, Lex and Spenny, had to kind of like hold it down for everybody. So it's a really dope documentary. I highly recommend it. You know, the late great T.C. Islam said that hip hop is an African form of an oppressed creativity. And this is it right here. So these artists, these young brothers, they listen to drill rap out of the UK, a group called the Harlem Spartans, which are actually pretty dope as well. They were actually pretty dope. And all of those guys went to jail. So they were inspired by them. So they started rapping. And it was kind of like an outlet for them. They were bangers. They were gangbangers. This is that they different to how we do in the United States. Because in places like Australia and the UK, guns are illegal, period. You know, whereas in the United States, in most states, guns are legal. Like, I live in Ohio. It's an open carry state, you know. So you can acquire guns very easily in the United States, whereas in places like the UK, Australia, you cannot. So a lot of these kids resort to fisticuffs, just like cats did back in the day in the 40s and 50s. Chains, you know, whips, you know, brass knuckles, hammers, you know, baseball bats, pipes, you know, wooden seats from wooden legs from seats. Like, this is the kind of stuff they do. And they got it in. The music is dope, though. I'm not going to lie. So it shows how they blew up and how every time they try to perform in Australia, the police shut them down. So when they try to go to New Zealand, police shut them down. And then they will perform one time because of a rapper who kind of reminds me of, what's the name of that white singer in this country? It looked like him. I can't believe he's a rapper. But, you know, it's Australia, right? And he brought them on stage and they performed. So, but the police try to shut them down at every opportunity, got some of them, you know, detained before they can travel throughout Australia. And Australia's a big country, because I know, like, we like to think that it isn't, but if you look on a map, it should be a continent. Australia should be a continent. It's that big. And they inspired other groups. But I think, like I said, two of the artists went to jail. Real interesting. It's just real interesting. I think I introduced it to my students and they were like, yo, who are these guys? And they were really interested on how hip hop, like, they absorbed hip hop culture and they kind of like made it their own. They were real interested in that. And then they kind of like saw the parallels between how they come up and how the brothers in 1-4 and Mal Truitt came up. So real interesting, something I thought there were perspective to look at when you talk about the 50th anniversary of hip hop. So definitely check it out. It's on Netflix. Word. It's been a minute since I've done this, but I gotta do it. Haven't done a shout out in a grip, you know what I mean? And that's like the essence of how we do things here. Definitely gotta give a shout out to the big homie Ethan at Ace Hardware Clifton. You know who you is. Shout you out for looking out and supporting the show, man. That means a lot to me. And that shout out to the big homie with the kilt and the big beard. Yo, I ain't know my man was Mexican, bro. He was in there chopping it up. Every time I go into Arrow and Wine, we be chopping it up, man. But he said I couldn't mention his name, so I'm not. So shout out to you, big homie. Word is born. First of all, thank you for listening to Where My Killer Tape At. You could have been anywhere else, but here you are. So I appreciate your support. I know I've been saying this every year, but I'm still trying to sell 100 coffee mugs. The link is in there. It's from Cafe Press. Please support the podcast. I wanted to remain as independent as fuck. Now, if you want to continue the conversation, you can do it on Spills or on Threads. And just make sure you hashtag Where My Killer Tape At. Killer is spelled K-I-L-L-A. If you want to get a hold of me, I can be found on Spills at Dan Trezomi, on Instagram and Threads at Brother Omi. And that's B-R-O-T-H-E-R-O-M-I. Dan Trezomi is spelled D-A-N-T-R-E-S-O-M-I. So definitely support. Go to the website, omisbench.com, O-M-I-S, bench, B-E-N-C-H.com, and all my information will be on there. Thank you for supporting the show, and we'll see you next time. Peace.